Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR, you're on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and sorry I haven't been around the last few weeks. It's been really, really busy, and I haven't really got a lot of time as I record this this week, but I want to turn it over to a interview that Rania Kalik, Lebanese-American journalist, did with the Electronic Intifada just this past week, which was really good. Talked about basically Israeli escalation in the war in Palestine, its threats to invade Lebanon, and basically what the Palestinian resistance and the Lebanese resistance is doing about that, and how basically if Israel actually does go into Lebanon, it's going to be game over for Israel. It's going to be game over for Israeli apartheid, because these resistance forces, they're prepared, and they mean business. So without further ado, I'm gonna turn it over to the Electronic Intifada, which you all should be listening to, by the way. Every Wednesday they put out their podcast. Check that out every week. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
We're delighted to be joined now by Rania Kalik. Rania is a journalist with Breakthrough News, a non-profit media outlet providing independent, fact-based reporting and commentary, just like us here at the Electronic Intifada. Rania is the host of the show Dispatches. It's probably my favorite current affairs program, providing some of the most probing and insightful interviews on the situation in Western Asia, and on geopolitics more generally. I've been honored to be a guest on Rania's show several times, and she's really a brilliant interviewer. So I'm a bit nervous about being on the other side, and I hope that we can do as good a job as Rania does. Rania is based in Lebanon, and she's coming to us now from Beirut. Welcome to the live stream, Rania.
Thank you so much for having me, Ali. And I'm anxious about being on the other side because you're one of my favorite people to interview, and you're always so eloquent and wonderful and full of so much information. So I hope I can do this justice.
Thank you. I'm sure you will. And I think it's going to be a great conversation. So let's get started. And I want to start by asking you about a report which appeared in the British right-wing newspaper, The Daily Telegraph, a couple of weeks ago, which claims that the resistance group Hezbollah is storing weapons, including long-range missiles, at Beirut Airport. What's the motivation for the report, which, by the way, the Telegraph sources to so-called whistleblowers, and what's been the reaction to it in Lebanon?
Well, I want to point out the title of the report actually changed because of the reaction to it. There was a lot of peculiar things about this particular report. I mean, of course, we expect lots of propaganda from an outlet like The Telegraph, which is constantly denying Israeli war crimes and repeating Israeli lies. But this report in particular had no byline, which was quite strange. There's no byline, there's at least something that says, you know, written by Telegraph staff or something along those lines. But there was nobody put their name on this report, which made it a bit odd. On top of that, the title changed initially. The title stated as fact that there are Hezbollah weapons being placed or being stored at the Beirut airport. And then there was such an outcry about that, and including from people who are anti-Hezbollah, by the way, that they ultimately went back and changed the title to, you know, airport bosses deny that Hezbollah stores weapons at the airport. And the other thing about it that's really important to note is that there's something called the International Air Transport Association, which I was not familiar with before this report. But in the report, the Telegraph had quoted this International Air Transport Association, or IATA, as having it was a quote attributed to an unnamed IATA source, essentially confirming that, yes, this is what's happening at the airport. But after this report came out, the IATA released a statement clarifying that the quote was entirely false. And they said IATA has not and will not comment on the situation at Beirut Airport. And they emphasize that it doesn't even involve itself in political or security matters in Lebanon and does not provide commentary on such issues. They also noted that they contacted the Telegraph to correct this error. And so the newspaper responded and updated the report by removing IATA's name from the article. But then I don't even think they added a correction to it, by the way, which is the most shoddy thing you can possibly do. There's no retraction, no correction, just changing the title, no byline. It was really bizarre. Furthermore, I mean, this is the kind of report that, you know, I would think that maybe like an intelligence official threw into the newspaper. I have no idea. That's pure speculation. I can't prove that. But it was just such a bizarre report. And it's frightening to see that be placed in a media outlet, even one as, you know, propagandistic as the Telegraph, because that puts the Beirut airport in danger. You're essentially making it a military target based on lies. There was, you know, so-called whistleblowers quoted throughout, but nobody was really named except for like one Lebanese forces official that was called up, you know, and just said, yeah, that's probably true. And Lebanese forces is a political party and, you know, fascist militia in Lebanon that's aligned with the U.S. and aligned with Israel. So somebody from that party would say that. But the point is that this to me looked like the Israelis and their allies within this outlet trying to justify bombing Beirut Airport. And I want to be clear here, Hezbollah, it's very unlikely, like, I'm like almost 100% sure Hezbollah does not store their weapons at the Beirut airport. That's not how the Beirut airport works. Hezbollah doesn't control the Beirut airport. There are different factions in Lebanon that all have some security like measures over the Beirut airport, but not in a way where Hezbollah could store weapons there. That's not how Hezbollah brings weapons into the country. And again, placing an article like that is very dangerous because, you know, this is how Israel, if there is a war on Lebanon, a bigger one than there is now, would get away with being able to just point to this and say, oh, see, this article was in the Telegraph. And I'm sure Matt Miller would go along with that in order to bomb a civilian airport.
Yeah, it's a bit like how before the, as the genocide was just getting underway in Gaza, the Israel published this cartoon animation showing the multi-level Hamas headquarters that supposedly existed under Al-Shifa Hospital as a pretext to bomb it. So it looks like it could be something like that.
You know, Ali, it's also, this is part of the Israeli playbook, because we can sit here and like laugh up at an article like this, just as we could have sat and laughed at the Israeli animation about Shifa Hospital. But look at the material consequences of those absurd lies. What we see is a mainstream media that's ultimately willing to take Israel's ridiculous, unproven fabrications and promote them as though they have some sort of legitimacy when Israel does go ahead and do something entirely crazy, like dismantling every single hospital in Gaza, or, you know, whatever it fantasizes about doing to Lebanon.
Yeah. So, Asa, do you want to introduce the video clip that we're going to show to Rania and get her comment on?
Sure. Yeah. Well, the Israeli Education Minister Yoav Kish, I think that's how you say his name, threatened in recent days that Israel will destroy Lebanon. So let's have a look at this clip.
לצרפתים ולאחרים מה שנקרא ממדינות העולם שטוענות את זה, אין שום הבדל בין חיזבאללה ללבנון. לבנון תושמד לאור כמו שהדברים מתקדמים. ואני אומר את זה אפילו עכשיו בצורה מאוד בוטה. אנחנו באירוע שבו לבנון הולכת לקראת השמדה. לא תהיה אותה לבנון כמו שהם מכירים. אני לא הולך להתעסק בצייד קטיושות של חיזבאללה. את המחיר לתוקפנות מאדמת לבנון תשלם מדינת לבנון.
ראש, סליחה, השר קיש, אתה השתמשת במילה, אני לא, אמרת, ביקשת שאני לא אקטע אותך. תושמד. השמדה יש לה במינוח העברי, אתה יודע, לשר הביטחון אמר תחזור לימי האבן.
אתה יודע מה, אני מתקן את דבריי, לא תושמד. לבנון כמו שאנחנו מכירים אותה לא תהיה קיימת, לבנון תשלם את המחיר הכבד בגלל חיזבאללה. ואני מתקן את דבריי, לא תושמד, אבל אני מדייק.
Yeah, so for people who are listening, it's kind of astonishing, really. I mean, essentially what he's saying there is that he's essentially threatening to annihilate Lebanon.
I mean, that is the genocidal rhetoric that we're used to hearing from the Israelis. That is the education minister, by the way, of Israel. I mean, what a country. When the person in charge of your education ministry is threatening genocide against its neighbors. But I guess we've gotten so used to it here, whether we're talking about Palestinians or Israel, just referring to any of their of the neighboring countries. But we shouldn't allow that to be normalized rhetoric. Meanwhile, what you'll have in the U.S. media is a portrayal of Israel as some innocent victim against these evil terrorists called Hezbollah. You don't hear that kind of rhetoric, by the way. From Hezbollah. Yeah. You don't hear it from Hezbollah Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah. He always makes, you know, they make a distinction. They don't threaten to annihilate all of Israel. They don't threaten civilians. That was a threat of collective punishment against the civilian population of Lebanon, who he's saying have to pay a price for Hezbollah's aggression.
Absolutely. Like the exact words he used were, Lebanon as we know it will not exist. And he said there's no distinction between Hezbollah and Lebanon, and he asserted that Lebanon would, quote, pay for Hezbollah's aggression and that it would be annihilated. So, Rania, what's the reaction in Lebanon to that statement? What have people been saying, and what's your reaction? I mean, these are kind of routine statements from Israeli leaders, as you mentioned. So, you know, what is the mood in Lebanon about this? You know, is it caused any kind of panic, or are people kind of used to it?
You know, I would say maybe in October, November, people were quite nervous. In Lebanon, you had a lot of the embassies issuing statements to, you know, the Western embassy saying leave while you can, while the commercial options are still available. You had airlines canceling flights. There was a fear, you could feel it in the air. It's all anybody was talking about was what was going to happen here, in addition to just being horrified by the images coming out of Gaza. And I mean, Israel did use Gaza as psychological warfare and still does about Lebanon. You'll constantly hear references from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, and basically anybody who goes and visits the north for some sort of PR tour in Israel will promise to turn Beirut into Gaza. And to do it to Lebanon, what they've done to Gaza. So in the first couple of months, people were quite frightened, including myself. I mean, it was scary to be here and to watch again, you know, for the first time, Israel was hitting parts of Gaza that in prior wars, it hadn't really touched. And the dismantling of hospitals, it was clear that this is a country that's gone completely mad more than usual and was willing to go way over all the supposed red lines. But I think at this point, it's become so normal and so routine to hear threats of annihilation and genocide from Israel that people have learned to live with it. And it's not normal, but it is normal here. So, I mean, right now it's tourist season in Lebanon. All the expats come and visit over the summer, and many people are still coming. They're bringing their families. And people just don't take the embassy warnings as seriously. They don't really take the Israeli threats as seriously. And there is a sense that, you know, even from people who strongly dislike Hezbollah, and there are a lot of those people in Lebanon, there is a sense that Hezbollah is in fact acting as a kind of deterrent to Israel turning Lebanon into Gaza. And we can talk more about what that means exactly. But I would say, you know, the mood here is kind of up and down. Every few couple months, there'll be something that makes everybody freak out for a day, and then it passes. And there does still seem to be some level of a priority of diplomacy over a massive escalation. So yeah, I would say sometimes I'm a little surprised. Sometimes I get a bit more worried than maybe like people who I would think would be worried, like family members who are coming to visit would be. So it's just normal. Genocidal rhetoric from Israel is normal.
Yeah, well, that's by itself is a pretty shocking statement. But let's talk a bit more about the internal political situation in Lebanon as it relates to the resistance. So as well as confronting Israel's military might, and over the past months, we've regularly featured reports on the incredible feats of the resistance in terms of the precision and the strength with which it's striking Israeli forces, surveillance equipment and monitoring equipment, and strategic targets all along the boundary. So as well as confronting Israel militarily, the Lebanese resistance also faces, as you mentioned, internal opposition from forces aligned with the United States, and even to some extent, Israel, as you mentioned, in the case of the Lebanese forces, militia or political party. And the U.S. has also led efforts to sabotage and hobble Lebanon's economy, which has been in really dire straits over the last 5 years. During his speeches, Hezbollah leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah often addresses his own countrymen and countrywomen who align with the West against the resistance, and he answers their claims that resistance is too costly. On the other side, you have anti-resistance forces who claim that Hezbollah is trying to take over Lebanon or makes decisions about the fate of the country without consulting anyone else. How do you see these internal dynamics developing at the moment? Is Hezbollah winning the domestic argument, or are these positions just too entrenched? What can you tell us about what's happening inside Lebanon?
So it's interesting, and I'll talk a bit about the sort of polarization in Lebanon. But before I do, I want to note that there was a poll done. And I mean, this was several months ago at this point, but it was an interesting poll nonetheless, because it was about Lebanese public opinion toward October 7. and towards Hezbollah's response essentially to October 7th and the general resistance response to, you know, well, what happened on October 8th and afterwards. And this was a polling firm called Information International, which is quite trusted. They conducted this survey, and they found that 76% of Lebanese supported Hamas's attack, which was interesting. 17% were neutral, 8% opposed. And then split by sect, 93% among Shias and Druze were in support, 88% of Sunnis, and even 50% of Christians. And that's an important number because oftentimes throughout Lebanon's history, recent history, the Christian community has been, the West has attempted to co-opt the Christian community in pretty significant ways. And even as I've initially tried to turn, like, wanted Lebanon to be the sort of Christian country that could be alongside the Jewish country of Israel. And some of the parties that are supported by the West in Lebanon are these like fascistic parties that have like a very Christian nationalistic identity. And then on Hezbollah's involvement, you had 48% opposed to Hezbollah's participation in the war, 27% in favor, and then 26% neutral. But if Lebanon comes under attack, 43% support Hezbollah's involvement, which is actually a plurality compared to who would have opposed it. So those are interesting numbers because of how they break down across sect, because it was pretty consistent across sect, just to see ultimately, except for the sort of 50-50% among Christians, that a majority of people would support the resistance efforts in these different sects. And I mean, all that's to say, you know, Lebanon does have a very polarized political infrastructure where you have parties not only based on sect, but there's sort of two camps. One of the camps is the sort of like pro-resistance camp that has a bunch of parties behind it of many different sects. And then one of them is the sort of anti-resistance pro-US camp. And what's important to understand about that is while the majority of the country, while the country as a whole isn't like all behind whatever Hezbollah does, Hezbollah is not just a armed group, it's also a political group, and it is elected to parliament. The last elections we had were in 2022, where Hezbollah won 13 seats, and it's part of the largest parliamentary bloc. The parliament as a whole has 128 seats, and the Hezbollah aligned bloc has over 60 seats. So that's, I mean, significant because, you know, the U.S. always talks about how important voting and democracy are. And so Hezbollah and its allies have been voted into government more than America's allies. That said, there are U.S. and Saudi-backed parties that are anti-Hezbollah, and they make a lot of their campaigns about disarming Hezbollah. And oftentimes you'll hear them talk about normalizing and peace with Israel. And I'm saying that's an important word to use when we talk about Lebanon and Israel, the idea of peace, because Israel still occupies land in Lebanon and used to occupy huge parts of Lebanon. But all that's to say, the U.S. plays a significant role, and its regional allies, though less so these days, play a pretty significant role in basically funding political parties, in some cases arming political parties that have aligned fascistic militias as an attempt to try to deter Hezbollah. It hasn't worked, though. Hezbollah is very well organized. Hezbollah is armed very well. And again, I think a lot of people recognize that this group, this organization, is the one thing standing in the way of Israel turning Lebanon into Gaza.
Yeah, 100%. Well, we've got a propaganda video here to show, which was posted by the Israeli army a few days ago. Let's take a look at that now, if we could.
This flag around lately, do you recognize it? Do you know what it stands for? This is the flag of the Hezbollah terrorist organization, a Lebanese militia funded, trained, and controlled by Iran. Founded in 1982, it's been led by Hassan Nasrallah, its secretary general, since 1992. In its 42 years of existence, they have managed to become the world's most dangerous and best-funded terrorist organization, with over 100,000 terrorist operatives and an arsenal of over 200,000 rockets. But Hezbollah doesn't just want to eliminate Israel. They've repeatedly claimed that their end goal is to completely eliminate the U.S. and the West. Hear it from them.
وأنا بجاوبك مش المعركة مع إسرائيل. إسرائيل هي عبارة عن أداة تنفيذية. المعركة الأساسية والحقيقية هي مع أمريكا.
Recently, many of these flags have made appearances around the world, used as a facade to whitewash Hezbollah. But just remember, The next time you see someone with a Hezbollah flag, that the only thing this represents is terrorism and death.
I couldn't help laughing a little bit at the forced Israeli pronunciations of...
can they not say that? Like, what's up with that? They can say Hebrew.
You know, it's funny because they have, you know, a large segment of the Israeli Jewish population who are of Arab origin and who pronounce the letter Ha and who can say Hezbollah. They don't have to say Hezbollah. So I think that it's a racist choice. I think it's deliberate because they could say Hezbollah. They have no shortage of people who can pronounce the letter
Ha. She also said Hassan Nasrallah.
No, it's like the Hamas, the Hezbollah, the, you know, they like to list the Hassan Nasrallah. Anyway.
Also, her accent was American. She can say the H. Like, she can make an H sound. I know that girl who voiceovered that. It is racist. Yeah. I agree with you. I think it's racist. I think they just like to say it to be condescending.
It's an interesting phenomenon in Israeli society, actually. In all seriousness, I know we make fun of it, but I think you're right, Ali. It is a racist choice. I also think it's perhaps Israelis' way of presenting themselves to the West as like the experts on, you know, on the Arabs. You know, in this kind of war on terror kind of way. But the irony, of course, is that they're getting it wrong. Yeah. But Rania, what's your reaction to that video? What's your reaction to that video? And as a very basic question for maybe, you know, might be interesting for a lot of our viewers and listeners, when was Hezbollah founded and why does it exist?
Well, my reaction to the video, Asa, is it's just bad propaganda. I mean, I don't know. Like, it even contradicts itself. The clip they showed of the Hezbollah official speaking, where she's like, he wants to destroy America, or they want to destroy America ultimately, was actually him saying something very correct, which is that America is like Israel's America's puppet. And America is the main enemy. I mean, if you just for an imperialist, in imperialist terms. So I just think that video is bad propaganda, and I think it demonstrates that Israel would have a bit of an uphill battle, just as it has. I mean, all of its propaganda has been really, really bad. But that said, you know, I think it's important to recognize, and probably a lot of your viewers already have some understanding of this, but it's important to always reemphasize why Hezbollah exists. It didn't just come out of nowhere. It didn't just decide to organize itself to hate Israel. Israel committed several atrocities, one after another, against Lebanon during Lebanon's civil war, which a lot of countries were involved with, including the U.S. and Israel, who were funding, and France, by the way, who were funding and arming fascist sectarian militias that also committed atrocities. And in 1982, Israel put a siege on Beirut, starved people. I mean, a lot of what you see happening in Gaza, Israel did. In Beirut in 1982, they also invaded Lebanon, occupied many areas, including, I'll add, my own family's home was occupied by the Israelis.
And by the way, sorry to interrupt you, Rania, that was the siege of Beirut.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the massacres that then happened in the Sabra Shatila refugee camps. That was the siege of Beirut that President Ronald Reagan compared to the Holocaust, just to provide context.
Yeah, he called up Menachem Begin and told him,
the Israeli prime minister at the time.
Right, at the time. And told him, what you're doing is like a Holocaust. Stop. It's like too brutal. And he joked around. There's like a back and forth that's been transcribed. He joked back to Ronald Reagan, like, don't throw that word around. Like, we know what a Holocaust is. And he's like, no, seriously, stop. And within 20 minutes, they stopped. Which also shows the power America actually does have over Israel, but President Biden is choosing not to use, because he wholeheartedly backs this genocide. So I'm glad you brought that up. But yes, Ronald Reagan called it a Holocaust. I think in the course of like a couple months, they killed like 20 or 30,000 people. What they did to Beirut was disgusting, just as what they're doing to Gaza. And that's just, I mean, you know, we could sit here and talk for hours about what Israel has done to Lebanon. And Israel ultimately, what they did to my family's home was like the least atrocious thing compared to what they did to other parts of Lebanon. But they occupied my grandmother's house and left their feces everywhere and like smeared it on the walls. In addition to, you know, their Star of David graffiti, that's what they do. And then they expect you to love them and call you an anti-Semite if you don't. After they do that to your home. But all that's to say, you know, Israel invaded, starved, and occupied Lebanon. The Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon lasted from 1985 during the Lebanese Civil War up until 2000, which was many years after the Lebanese Civil War ended. And in that time, committed atrocity after atrocity after atrocity. In southern Lebanon specifically, they ran torture facilities. They funded a fascist militia called the South Lebanon Army to act on their behalf, and on and on and on. So it was out of these horrors that Hezbollah emerged in the South as resistance to Israel's occupation in the 80s and continued to resist. And of course, Israel and the U.S. call them terrorists. I mean, can you imagine labeling people terrorists for preventing you or trying to prevent you from stealing their homes and killing their families? I mean, that's just what they do to Palestinians. It's what they do to Lebanese, to anybody who stands up for their land and their families. They're all terrorists, according to the Americans and the Israelis. But Hezbollah became a very powerful organization. And I want to also note it was one among many. There was many different political groups that had armed wings that fought the Israelis throughout this time. But Hezbollah emerged as the strongest and most formidable and well-organized one. And in 2000, they kicked the Israelis out of southern Lebanon. And it was a huge victory for the region. I mean, this was the first time Arabs had managed to liberate their land from Israeli occupation in such a dramatic way. And then they also fought a war in 2006, where Israel, again, this was a 33-day war in the summer of 2006. Israel committed massacre after massacre. And Hezbollah fought very fiercely against the Israelis. I mean, Israel tried to invade and they couldn't. Like, they could barely take a hill in southern Lebanon. And that was back in 2006. Israel basically, after 33 days, had to admit defeat. You know, despite doing what they do best, which was killing civilians. Israel killed over 1,000 Lebanese civilians that summer. But they also lost 121 soldiers, which at the time was quite unprecedented because, you know, Israel's supposedly the strongest military force in the region. And Hezbollah is like this far weaker militia. But I think this is when the image of Israel as the strongest power ever started to crack. And then we saw, you know, I think Hamas deliver a bit of a death blow on October 7th. But all that's to say, it's this environment in which Hezbollah emerged and continues to exist because Israel has not stopped being a threat to Lebanon. In fact, even now you see there's this crazy, well, they call it a crazy organization that has greater Israel ambitions that's planning on colonizing southern Lebanon for when Israel invades and takes it, as they believe it's what's going to happen. So, you know, and Israel, again, has consistently since 2006, despite not actually doing it, has threatened regularly. I mean, I've lived in Lebanon the past 7 years, and in all these 7 years, I've lost count of the times I've heard Israeli officials threaten to send Lebanon back to the Stone Age, threaten to annihilate Lebanon, threaten to reoccupy and invade Lebanon.
But Rania, just to play devil's advocate for a second. So, you know, you're saying Hezbollah is there to defend Lebanon against Israel and to defend the South. And by the way, the South, the Hezbollah and the other resistance factions defeated Israel on the 25th of May 2000, when Israeli forces fled along with their Lebanese collaborators, the South Lebanon Army, and they just literally fled. I visited about 3 or 4 weeks later. I was going to Lebanon, and I went to the South with some friends from the South, and we had an incredible tour. We went to the Qiyam prison, where Israel had tortured people for decades. And we even visited Israeli military positions that were abandoned. I remember seeing open cans of food, like they were in the middle of eating their rations when the order came from Prime Minister Ehud Barak at the time to abandon and flee, and they left Lebanon. So it was incredible to see that situation. But that was 20-some years ago. Lebanon has an army, don't they? Why do they need Hezbollah?
And that's a great question, right? If Lebanon has an army, this is what the Americans always say. The Americans are always saying, oh, you know, Hezbollah unilaterally makes these decisions that put Lebanon in harm's way. The Israelis say this too. The Americans are big proponents of the Lebanese army. The Lebanese army is basically entirely armed by the Americans. But when I say armed, I want to clarify what those arms mean. I mean, they get hand-me-down night vision goggles and guns that barely work. That's the kind of arms the Americans give to the Lebanese army. And then they say this is what's supposed to protect Lebanon, as they provide Israel with as many bunker buster bombs that weigh 2,000 pounds as they want. So it's a way of rigging the situation. And I also want to note that the U.S. has repeatedly pressured Lebanon to reject military packages from other countries. This is actually WikiLeaks cables revealed that this happened with the Russians. The U.S. pressured Lebanon to reject back in 2008 a Russian military package that included tanks and fighter jets and ammunition. And so they actually, you know, sabotage efforts to arm Lebanon in any significant way that could be used against the Israelis. This happened again. The Russians actually came and offered the Lebanese back in, I think it was maybe 2012, sometime around that time, they came and offered the Lebanese a $1 billion weapons package over 15 years with no interest on the repayments. And this time it actually seemed like it might go through. And the president approved it. The army approved it. The defense minister was about to sign it on his trip to Moscow. But there was intense pressure from both the U.S. and the U.K. Ambassadors in Lebanon that essentially forced then Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri, Saad Hariri, to basically put the deal in the garbage. So once again, that's the U.S. getting in the way and becoming an obstacle to Lebanon getting arms. They don't just use this with arms, by the way, just as an aside. They do this with infrastructure. China has repeatedly offered to provide, and I know this from people inside sources in the Lebanese government who've dealt with this, Chinese officials have repeatedly offered to just do basic infrastructure packages for Lebanon, like whether it's like building a power station or helping with port stuff. And Lebanon could really use that, given that its economy has been crumbling since 2019. It's one of the worst economic catastrophes of the century. And whenever Chinese officials visit and make offers like that, the next day, Lebanese officials will receive a visit from the U.S. embassy threatening sanctions if they dare go through with any projects from China. So the U.S. stands in the way from Lebanon having functioning infrastructure from other countries, and it stands in the way certainly from Lebanon having any weapons that could actually help it have a measure of self-defense. So you have the U.S. and the West generally basically sabotaging Lebanon's capacity as a state to defend itself from an aggressive colonizing neighbor. So what is Lebanon supposed to do? What is Hezbollah supposed to do? Just put down their weapons and say, please, welcome, do as you please, and hope for the best? That no one would do that in their right mind, especially given Israel's history. And I would also add, we need to look at what Israel's doing in Gaza right now. They're committing a genocide. They've destroyed hospitals. We know from a New York Times investigation that they are sodomizing people to death with hot metal sticks. They are raping people. I mean, the list goes, they're beheading people with bombs. I mean, the list goes on and on. I have a friend I talked to today whose family in Gaza, they've lost 160 members. And that story, Ali, you've heard it from tons of people as well. Everyone's lost 100 or more family members. The only thing standing in the way of rape and massacres and torture and concentration camps and death on a mass scale in Lebanon is Hezbollah. And so, I mean, for the U.S. and Israel to sit there and talk about this as a terrorist organization and demand they put down their weapons, it's a joke.
Well, and I think there's a parallel there with the Palestinian Authority, which the U.S. and the EU and other enemies of the Palestinian people in the West help to arm and train. And they have tens of thousands of Palestinian Authority so-called security forces who are simply not allowed to defend Palestinians against the genocidal Zionist state. So I think there's a parallel there with how they may see the role of the Lebanese army. But let's shift to some of the regional picture, Rania. As you know, for decades, the US and Israel have tried to foment sectarian conflict across the region as a divide and rule strategy between followers of the Sunni and Shia traditions in Islam. And of course, Hezbollah is generally associated with the Shia tradition. We saw this in Iraq after the US-led aggression and occupation in 2003, and we saw it escalate again after Israel invaded Lebanon in 2006 with full US backing. In 2006, as you noted, Israel was badly defeated and humiliated by Hezbollah, which raised Hezbollah's popularity, legitimacy, and profile across the Arab world. I remember that very clearly. They were seen as heroes, as anti-colonial resistance heroes, acting on behalf of the whole Arab world. So following that, we saw a big push by pro-American Saudi media, among others, to define Hezbollah as a Shia Iranian proxy, and even as a foreign force in Lebanon, despite the fact that Hezbollah is made up of Lebanese people. Do you think this strategy worked, or to what extent do you think it worked? And what changes are you seeing now, especially since October 7th, in that kind of regional sectarian picture?
I mean, I think it worked to a degree for sure, for a significant period of time, especially after the Arab Spring in 2011. A lot of the sort of anti-Shia groundwork was laid ahead of 2011, and then was sort of put into effect. Before I get to that, I just want to note, you mentioned Iraq, and I think one of the ironies about Iraq is that before 2003, when the US was building up to invade and occupy Iraq, it was evil Sunni Saddam who was going to genocide all the Shias. That was the narrative, is this, you know, the Sunnis were the Nazis and the Shias were the Jews of Iraq, if you will. And if we don't go in and invade, I mean, that was one of the talking points you'd hear, is that there's going to be like a Holocaust against Shias. And then after the US invaded and occupied, and there was both Sunni and Shia militias, and there were Shia militias fighting the US occupiers, you had a change around. And then suddenly it was the big bad Shia militias of Iraq. And the Sunnis became, you know, the Jews who were faced with a Holocaust. So it's interesting the way the Americans want to change those, you know, those characterizations at the snap of a finger, depending on what behooves America. And we know one thing's for sure: America doesn't care about any Arabs, regardless of their sect. They can be Christian, they can be Muslim of any sect, they can be Druze, it doesn't matter. It's just what benefits the U.S. That said, you're right. After 2006, that Hezbollah victory over Israel, that the region celebrated, was seen as a huge threat. And I remember there was that Seymour Hersh article, I think it was probably in the New Yorker at the time, it was called maybe The Redirection. And it was when Dick Cheney, and I think the intelligence chief at the time of the Saudis, got together and decided to basically put their efforts behind demonizing Shias across the region, to demonize Hezbollah, specifically Iran, to try to divide and conquer, as they always do. And so when 2011 rolled around, you had the Arab Spring, you had the Syrian government framed in this way of like being some anti-Sunni genocidal government against Sunnis, that's backed by big bad Shia Iran, and that Sunnis across the region are under threat from like Iraq to Lebanon by these evil Shias who are actually all agents of Iran. That's what the Gulf media, funded media in the region would say. Sadly, even Al Jazeera bought into this at the time, or promoted this at the time. And it did have lasting damage, I think, in terms of how people view groups like Hezbollah in Lebanon. They are viewed even internally by some Lebanese as agents of Iran. In fact, there's even a talking point you'll hear from the sort of pro-American elements of Lebanon, that there's an Iranian occupation of Lebanon. And by Iranian occupation, they mean Hezbollah is Iran and occupying Lebanon, whereas actually Israel occupies Lebanon. So it's kind of just an amazing rhetorical upside down planet they live on.
Yeah, it's a really sort of chauvinist, sectarian argument, isn't it?
Saying it's racist. It's racist because
not Lebanese, they're right. Secret Iranians.
Well, yeah, you're taking away their identity as people that are indigenous to Lebanon, that are defending their land. You don't have to love them, but All that said, so yes, that has done significant damage. And there's also a lot of NGOs that are funded across the region, a lot of that kind of promote the same ideas. However, I would say October 7th, and maybe even, you know, the war on Gaza in 2021 by Israel was sort of the beginning of this, undid some of that. Hamas and Hezbollah in Syria initially were on opposite sides. Because, you know, Hamas is an arm of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood in Syria, or is aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood.
Or it was originally. It emerged from the Muslim Brotherhood.
Right. And it has.
It's independent now.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. But like in Syria, there was this kind of natural affinity because a lot of, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria was obviously very anti-government and was a part of a lot of the fighting against the government. And initially, Hamas in Syria did align with these groups. But actually, and you would hear this often from people who claim to be pro-Palestine, but wanted to be also, you know, pro-US intervention in Syria, they would say, but look, Hamas is against the regime. But actually, Hamas, because things went so disastrously wrong and it literally became a war between the Syrian state and this collection of Salafi jihadist groups, some of whom included Al-Qaeda and ISIS, Hamas then switched sides.
And groups openly backed by Israel.
Yes. You know,
and had Hamas not switched sides, they would have ended up fighting on the side of Israel.
And not just Hamas, you know, I visited Syria a few times, and I actually went to the Golan, the Syrian controlled part of the Golan, and talked to people who initially fought on the side of the opposition, but quickly saw that the opposition was working with the Israelis and switched back to the government side. So a lot of that happened. It didn't get much attention in Western press, obviously. But all that's to say, October 7th has undone a lot of that. I mean, even in Lebanon, the Muslim Brotherhood in Lebanon is now aligned with Hezbollah and is fighting in coordination with Hezbollah against Israel. So that's, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood's a Sunni group. And this is, again, the Muslim Brotherhood in Lebanon specifically. And you even have so much concern about that and the fact that the Sunni community in Lebanon supports this fight against Israel, that the Washington Institute for Near East Policy published basically a lobbying article recently. One of the co-writers for it was Hanin Ghaddad, a Lebanese woman who is considered a traitor by many people in her community in this country because of her advocacy for the destruction of Lebanon. But basically asking the U.S. government to sanction Lebanon's Muslim Brotherhood because it's now working with Hezbollah, and to get Saudi Arabia to come back into the country and to start supporting the Sunni community again, lest they be lost to Hezbollah. So you actually have some of what the U.S. has done has become undone by October 7th, because October 7th has, you know, re-emphasized or reminded people in the region who the real enemy is. And the real enemy is this settler colonial state backed by the United States trying to destroy the region. And so you're seeing, you know, attempts or efforts or suggestions for efforts to once again to kind of reinvigorate the sectarian divide. But right now it's not working. And I think that's really positive.
And I think it's really significant that in his speeches, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of the Secretary General of Hezbollah, never uses sectarian rhetoric. He is very anti-sectarian, and he gave a recent speech to thank people for the condolences they gave for the passing of his mother. And I thought it was very notable that he was talking about his life and his childhood. It was a very personal speech. And he talked about growing up in a poor working class neighborhood. I forget the name of it. But he talked about how when he was growing up, this was before the Civil War, there were Sunni and Shia and Christians of all different traditions, and people of Armenian background and Kurds and so on. And he said, my memories of that neighborhood and how people were living together is the model I want for the future of Lebanon. So that's the rhetoric that Hezbollah consistently uses. Now you can say, oh, well, he doesn't mean it. Or I mean, you can put whatever analysis you want on it. But the point I'm making is they do not seek to exacerbate with their rhetoric sectarian divisions. It is very much the United States and its allies, and Israel and its allies, who used that sectarian rhetoric, who, for example, warned years ago about a so-called Shia crescent across the region, as if this was kind of a threat. You can imagine someone talking about a Jewish crescent and how anti-Semitic that would be perceived as. So to talk about a Shia crescent or the Shia population as a threat is just as bigoted. But I think it's really significant. Rania,
can I just add one thing to what you said? I want to also note that Nasrallah makes a very clear point about separating the understanding of Zionism and Judaism as well. Like, he's not sectarian when it comes to Jews either. And I think that's important to say too. He's also somebody who recognizes that it's not Israel controlling things, it's the US, and that US imperialism is the primary problem. So I would say across the board, but yeah, please go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you, Rania. And just, you're going to stay with us, but we're going to close out this segment with just, I just want to sort of come out to the regional picture and just get your thoughts on that. Hezbollah, of course, sees itself, as we've talked about, as part of a bigger regional resistance front, which includes the Palestinian resistance, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Iran. Talk about this regional front. How robust is it? Is it winning? Is it doing enough? And I also want you to talk about the position of the U.S. in the region. Is it on the decline? Is the resistance front winning? And just give us your thoughts on kind of the bigger regional picture.
I mean, I think that this is such a significant moment in history, not only because there's a horrific genocide that's the worst thing that's happened so far this century, but also because for the first time we see this kind of united resistance across the region. This is not the Middle East of 2003, where the U.S. can just come in with bulldozers and take out an entire country with zero effort to push back. You have various groups across the region, in some cases countries, that are aligned together. They call themselves the Resistance Axis. And we're seeing them for the first time coordinate together against a bigger enemy. And so, of course, first and foremost, you have Hamas in Gaza. I mean, they are fighting the primary fight, right? And they're still fighting quite fiercely, as you all talk about regularly on this program. And you know, John Elmer is really good at laying out the military analysis of that. And you also have Palestinians fighting in the West Bank, which is, you know, I think if it wasn't for what's happening in Gaza, that what's happening in the West Bank would be international headlines. But, you know, Gaza is like so horrific, it's easy to for other things to kind of like, you know, be overshadowed. You have the front in Lebanon. That's another front where Hezbollah is, you know, playing a huge role in deterring Israel with a tit for tat that you've talked about on this show. That's quite significant. And again, you know, is the only reason Israel has, what are we on, 200? I'm sorry, you counted 276. Is that what today is of this horror show? In 276 days, Israel, you know, every war in the past, Israel would bomb the airport in the first days of it. So far, it's been 276 days, and the airport in Beirut, still till now, I mean, that could change, but it still stands. And that is because of the Lebanese resistance. You have a resistance that has emerged in Iraq, made up of a collection of groups that fought ISIS and, you know, have an anti-imperialist bent and see themselves as resistance to the U.S. And there's this group that emerged, the Islamic Resistance of Iraq. It's a little bit vague who exactly is a part of this group, but it's a collection of these groups, some of whom fought with the Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq against ISIS, who have been in coordination or in solidarity with Hamas in Gaza, have been hitting near the U.S. or striking towards the U.S. embassy or other places, and in some cases actually striking Israel. And that's never happened before. I mean, the striking of the U.S. has, but not Israel. That hasn't happened, and that's new, and it's happened pretty regularly, I would say, since October 7th, as regular as it can get from Iraq. And these are also groups that are promising, if this expands to Lebanon, they will come to Lebanon and fight from there. And they're promising to do more damage to what are sitting ducks, U.S. assets that are sitting ducks across Iraq that don't really have the ability to protect themselves from rockets from these groups if they were to ramp up the frequency. You have also, I think, one of the most important things to happen was the Yemenis. You know, the Ansar Allah, which is known more popularly in the U.S. as the Houthis, actually inflicting material damage, material consequences on the Israelis by stopping ships headed for Israel and disrupting, you know, this international shipping channel, which has been huge. And, you know, you could describe as humanitarian intervention against a genocide. And also they have launched missiles at Israel as well. So you have this kind of coordination we haven't seen before. And then, of course, I want to mention Syria because, you know, you talked about the Israelis working with the Syrian opposition. Well, why would they do that? They would, because the government in Syria was aligned with this resistance axis and is a primary way for the resistance in Lebanon to get weapons, to be able to basically like have, get all these, like this big weapons capability they have today, they couldn't have without Syria as a kind of land crossing. And that would have been ruined had the U.S. and Israel been successful at completely collapsing the Syrian state and replacing the government there with a pro-U.S., pro-imperialist government.
Or with the failed state, like in Libya, and, you know.
Exactly. And there are certain parts of Syria that sort of became failed or are still kind of failed state zones in a way. But that said, there still is a government in Syria that is aligned with the resistance axis. And, you know, the people, I mean, I think it's an interesting thing to reflect on because there are people who attacked us for simply opposing a U.S. regime change scheme in Syria or an attempt to collapse the state in Syria on the basis that if you support Palestine, you have to support like a U.S. no-fly zone in Syria. And I think we see now that had those people won, you wouldn't see the strong resistance you see from Gaza to Lebanon. So I think it's really, go ahead.
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but I don't think I've heard any of those people, many of them residents at Washington think tanks and backed by the State Department and so on. I haven't seen any of them calling for a no-fly zone over Gaza.
They wouldn't dare. That would, that how could you? That would be like an act of terrorism if you were to ask those people. But yeah, I mean, I think like that when all of this together is significant, I think it's going to be one of these sort of historical moments that PhDs will be written about because of this collaboration. And, you know, I think what's interesting about it too is that the U.S. kind of had this self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. They kept saying, I mean, it's not a Shia crescent, but they kept fearing that if we don't change one regime after another, we're going to have these various groups and states be able to form an alliance against our imperialist interests in the region. And that's what we see now. And it's also at a time when the U.S. is, or has been, you know, very much trying to shift from its so-called war on terror, though it's more like a war of terror, focused on the Middle East or on West Asia, to this great power competition with Russia and China. And you've seen that shift, or the attempted shift, taking place beginning with the Obama administration. Any Pentagon white paper you read is almost entirely devoted to China, 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 Russia, Russia, Russia. You see it with the U.S. just continuing to flood Ukraine with weapons to try to bleed the Russians, fighting them to the last Ukrainian, with this obsession with Taiwan. I mean, even in that recent aid package that went to Israel, there was also a massive aid package attached to it going to both Taiwan and Ukraine. So the U.S. has been trying to, you know, get out of the Middle East and move towards its bigger enemy with these bigger competitors like China and Russia. And this has definitely become an obstacle to that. But I mean, as a result of shifting assets over the years, the U.S. is in a more precarious position in the Middle East, where they're not actually able to protect themselves very well, which is the one reason why they're still attempting to diplomatically avoid a bigger war with Lebanon, because they fear that, and they're not wrong to fear this, that if Israel launches a big war on Lebanon, it will draw in other regional players, and the U.S. will become a target in a way that it hasn't been yet. And they, a lot of damage can be done in that capacity. You have U.S. bases in Iraq. You have U.S. bases in all the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar. And you have, you know, and these aren't exactly places where the U.S. can necessarily, like, prevent every single rocket from coming in, every single missile from coming in. And even Israel itself, and I mean, you guys have done analysis on this show. That's way better than anything I could go into. But Israel is completely vulnerable to Hezbollah's weapons. And if Iran were to get involved in any way, I mean, you saw it took a week of advance notice and like five countries offering their air defenses to prevent those Iranian missiles, those 300 Iranian missiles from a couple months ago, from actually doing damage to Israel.
And that's when they had warning, you know, like the Iranians were saying, guys, we're going to attack. Guys, we're launching the missiles now. We're launching the drones. They're on their way. They're going to take hours and hours. We'd hate for you to get this much advance warning so that you can get all your forces ready. And the point is, from the analyses that I saw and I read, you know, it took the United States all of its military assets in the region, including those of its proxies and allies, to stop these slow-moving drones that they had plenty of warning about, and it cost billions of dollars. That one night cost billions of dollars. Whereas the missiles, which Iran really wanted to reach their targets, these two bases, one in, I think, was in the occupied Golan Heights, and one in the southern part of the country, those missiles hit. The U.S. wasn't able to stop them. So I think that your point is really well taken.
Thanks for watching this video. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel. Hit like, leave a comment. These engagements help us with the YouTube algorithm, and it helps us to get around Silicon Valley censorship as much as possible. It does make a difference. You can also support our journalism by going to electronicintifada.net and clicking on Donate Now. Thank you.